Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for May's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RCVS Recognised Specialist in Emergency and Critical Care, Lindsay Kellett-Gregory. Thank you, Lindsay. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Well, thank you, and welcome to today's webinar, where we're going to be talking about toxicology. And I don't know about you, but this is often my first interaction with an intoxication case. So we have an owner call up to say that their pet, usually a dog but not always, just got into something, ate something that they shouldn't. And at this point, it could be an open book. We could be dealing with any number of toxins, any number of clinical signs, and quite a variable severity of resultant disease or malfunction. So during this webinar, what we're going to do is we're going to cover hopefully a more practical sort of clinical approach to how we manage these cases that we can apply to really most of the toxicology cases that we'll encounter. And also over the course of the webinar, we're going to cover some solutions to things that are often listed as the top five mistakes made in poisoning cases. And as we can see from this list, none of these are things that are that difficult to circumvent, but we'll make sure that we cover all of these things today, as well as covering some additional methods to manage some specific toxicoses as well. And so when we're presented with any sort of poisoning or toxicity case, it's quite common and normal, in fact, for the mind to immediately go towards what are the expected effects of the toxin, how bad is this going to be, let's make the patient vomit as a sort of first line approach. And whilst that's absolutely important, and as we can see in this sort of list of things that we'll consider doing with any poisoning case here, that absolutely has its place in how we manage these patients. But what we can see straight away is that there's actually several important steps that we need to go through first before we get to that point, starting with initial patient assessment and life-saving measures if applicable. And it's, I guess, taking a step back, it's easy to see that we really need to be able to stabilize the patient and keep that patient alive, in fact, in order to specifically treat the intoxication. And so we'll cover the vast majority of the things on the list over the course of this webinar today. So very briefly going over that initial patient assessment we just mentioned, really any poisoning or toxicity patient should be treated like any other emergency, so really needs immediate triage or assessment after they present to the hospital just to establish how life-threatening is their situation currently and what can we potentially expect. And the way we do this is a very sort of streamlined approach going through the three sort of steps as listed here, the ABCs, the capsule history, and the major body systems assessment. The ABCs is the very first thing we do on meeting this patient and is actually the simplest, as in we're just checking to see is the patient mostly alive. So is there a patent airway? Is the patient breathing? And is there a heartbeat with pulses? And this is an assessment we're making very quickly. It's going to take just a matter of a few seconds. And if the answer to any of these questions is no, then we're looking at suctioning airways, intubating, breathing problems, starting CPR. That obviously becomes an immediate priority. The capsule history again applies to any emergency patient, but is basically in almost 30 seconds or less a sort of conversation with the owners as to why is their patient here. So just to kind of get that heads up as to that basic information about what are we going to be dealing with today, and obviously we'll expand on this a bit later once we've made sure that this patient is stable and is going to be okay, at least in the short term. And then we really need a way of figuring out when we turn to the actual clinical assessment of the patient, are they stable or not? And if there's any life-threatening effects of a toxic ingestion or exposure, then it will certainly manifest in an abnormality of one of the three body systems that we term the major body systems. And whilst there's obviously lots of organ systems in the body, in this very acute setting, we're really most worried about the heart, brain, and lungs. For the reason that if any one or indeed all three in a particularly bad day, if any of them malfunction, then we have very little wiggle room until we've got a patient who may not make it. And so we need to be able to assess them in a sort of pretty efficient and streamlined manner to say, is there something that's about to cause the early demise of the patient? And the really nice thing about this approach is that when we sort of list, as we have done on this slide here, the physical exam parameters we'd look at to see if those body systems are at risk, we can see that all of them are physical exam findings, so it's freely available information. And what we're doing with this this sort of triage approach is to basically assess each of these systems in isolation, just to make a blanket statement as if stable or not stable, so we can decide if we need to do any sort of emergency interventions before going any further. The next step that we outlined on the clinical approach that we saw at the start of the webinar was to take a full toxicity history as sort of the first opportunity after we've hopefully done that initial patient assessment and any subsequent stabilization that's really outside of sort of the scope of this webinar to discuss any further. And although, again, the temptation is to try and get this information up front, and if we can extract some of that without detrimenting the patient, great. But we really shouldn't be prioritizing this over the initial stabilization, because oftentimes, as we know, lots of toxicities don't have specific antidotes, and ultimately we're directing any treatment at the patient rather than a poison. But clearly, ultimately, we do need to find out more about the intoxication event. And so I've listed here some of the most useful questions to try and ensure that we collect all the information that would be helpful. So first off, singlement and estimated body weight, just so we can have in my mind how big a problem is this. Is this a breed-specific issue that might be more severely affected? How big is the patient in terms of how big was a potential exposure compared to their overall size? And then we want to pin down a bit more information about the exact exposure. Was it suspected or was it confirmed, as in was it the neighbour's poisoned the dog again for the third time this month due to an ongoing dispute, or is this an actual toxicity? How long ago did it happen? And as such, where would I expect that patient to be in terms of clinical signs? How were they exposed? And then a lot more information on the actual poison, or potentially sometimes poisons involved. So getting the specifics as to what actually it was, and the quantity, the concentration, so we can start working out an exposure dose. Figuring out the maximum and minimum amount. And occasionally we have patients who have just been found with a half-chewed box, say, for example, of ibuprofen, and we don't know exactly how much they've had. What can be useful to find out is whether or not the owner has a sense as to whether this was a full packet or a half-empty packet, just so we can start working out what our potential worst-case scenarios are. And on the subject of packaging, it's always useful to make sure that we're very, very clear on what they've been exposed to. For example, is it a sustained release product? And oftentimes extra letters written behind trade names may indicate that it's a sustained release product that we may need to handle a little bit differently. And ultimately, if the patient becomes presented to the practice, just having access to the container itself can be tremendously useful, just to make sure that we've sort of got all of the information that we possibly can about the exposure. We also want to know about clinical signs, the details, when they started, and progression, so we can get a sense as to, now we know the toxin, and what are we expecting? Is this in keeping with what we'd expect, or what can we sort of predict is going to come next? We also need to check on, verbally at least, the other patients in the house. And certainly I've had instances whereby it's not actually the pet that's been presented for the potential toxin exposure who's been the most severely affected one. It's been the quiet, well-behaved one who was sat at home, not really being thought of as being the guilty party. So it's always worth checking on sort of other animals to make sure that everybody's sort of accounted for in any exposure. And then we want to get an idea as just any existing medical conditions that may impact how a pet reacts to a particular toxin exposure. For example, do they have underlying kidney disease and now they've been exposed to a potentially nephrotoxic drug, for example? Any medications that could be relevant? And this is also a good time to check if any other medications have been given by the owner in relation to this particular exposure. And we certainly have clients who try and do good by giving various things to make their pets sick at home, such as salt water, that it's good for us to know of in case we need to treat the sort of the effects of any of those attempts as well. Once we know a bit more about the toxin and the specifics, then we can find out more to try and learn about how we'd expect that toxin to actually behave in the body, and as such what we can do specifically. And I've listed some of the specific things here that we'll be thinking of. So some examples being, what is the toxic dose, or like the lethal dose 50, which is the dose that will sort of take down 50% of the animals exposed to it. So you can get an idea as to how severe has this exposure been. Is this likely to be life-threatening, or is this something they'll get away with without any further treatment? Also think about mechanism of action. So what adverse effects can we expect? What are we looking for? Thinking about the nature of the toxin, as in, is it particularly acidotic or alkalotic, as in, am I expecting any injury to mucosal surfaces if it's a particularly caustic substance that's been ingested? How's the toxin been absorbed? So typically we're talking about exposure through the gastrointestinal tract, but of course we can think about maybe ocular exposure or dermal exposure, so thinking about how we can best decontaminate the patient. And then also thinking about properties like, how quickly is it absorbed? Does the toxin bind to charcoal? And those questions are really leading towards how we're best going to get this toxin out of the body, if that's still a possibility. The other considerations we'll think about are things to do with how it's metabolized. Given that we know some toxins, it's actually the metabolites are more dangerous than the initial sort of drug exposure itself. How is it excreted? Is there enterohepatic metabolism, which we'll talk about later, to say, are there extra ways that we can try and capture or get at this toxin to prevent it causing more harm to the patient? Thinking about other specific treatment targets, so is there an antidote available that we could use? Is it lipid soluble, as we'll come to talk about later? And then really predicting what clinical signs we're going to expect, and how long should they last in terms of when are we out of the woods, and how long might we need to provide treatment for. And so even though these are some pretty basic questions that all have quite a lot of relevance to the average toxicity patient, it's clearly a lot of information for us to sort of pull out of our heads at this time. And so what's almost as important is knowing where to look to find this sort of information. And I've listed some of the resources that I'll commonly use to look up the average toxin. Even if I think I remember it, it's always good to have a bit of a refresher. Just bearing in mind, we need to be able to access this information quite quickly. So making sure that we've got this to hand so we're sort of ready for any eventuality. We said that most of the time we'll see patients presenting with a known intoxication, but sometimes we'll see cases where poisoning wasn't even on our radar necessarily in terms of the history the owner comes in with, or it's suspected but in no means confirmed. And so I've listed here some other historical findings that we sometimes see that can raise suspicion for an intoxication as a cause of the clinical signs. And certainly one of the big ones that we tend to see is if we've had a previously healthy animal who's just suddenly become unwell, especially after being unsupervised for a period. Probably one of the biggest sort of, if they've read the textbook, case examples of a secret poisoning exposure. They can present with any sort of body systems malfunctioning, but certainly patients with new GI side effects or neurologic side effects are sort of in that, could this be a poisoning category? And again, if the neurologic side of things, if we've got a really sudden onset of progressive tremors, muscle twitching or seizures in an animal who was really previously healthy, nothing really to explain a potential neurologic issue coming into this, and especially if they've had a period of being unsupervised, is pretty suspicious for at least exploring the possibility of a toxin. But maybe it's a pet who's just had potential exposure to something because of a change in their management or environment, or even if they're in a house where they have access to veterinary human medications, even that if that's unlikely, it's something for us to bear in mind at least until we rule it out as a possibility. Moving on to actually treating the patient in our approach to the intoxicated patient, we've said a couple of times now that we're really aiming to treat the patient and not the toxin specifically. We're really treating the sort of the effects for the most part of what's going on. And so thinking back to our three major body systems again, it's obviously a priority that we get those sorted as soon as possible. And so treating the abnormalities we find, whether that be giving oxygen for a respiratory distress, whether that be getting quick seizure or tremor control with some of the drugs as listed here, is what we do is really going to depend on the specific patient and what they've been exposed to. And then other considerations we'll think about, again, they're going to depend on what we're predicting this toxin to do. So, for example, am I worried about what blood glucose might be if there's been xylitol exposure? Am I worried about coagulation abnormalities in the case of anticoagulant exposure? All of those sorts of things are going to come in. And so rather than list a whole series of all of the diagnostic tests we can run, at this point, we're really trying to hone in. What did we expect that toxin to do? And how could we or do we need to assess how that's affecting the patient with specific tests to answer that question? Moving along onto steps that we can take to minimize any further systemic toxin absorption. What I've chosen to do during this webinar today in the interest of time is just to focus on gastric or gastrointestinal decontamination rather than ocular or dermal exposure. Because it's probably one of the more common ones, but also in terms of mistakes that can be made and in terms of new information that's out there, this is the sort of the juicier topic to cover. We're going to start with talking about induction of emesis, and it's probably one of the most effective ways that we can minimize any further systemic poison absorption. And accordingly, we have a lot of owners who are very keen to start this process at home, using a variety of agents, just some of the ones listed here. And at the moment, unless there's extenuating circumstances, of which it's impossible to sort of make blanket statements, of course, but in the vast, vast majority of cases, it's really not recommended for owners to be using any of these agents. For one, we don't want any extra morbidity from attempts such as hypernatremia from giving them table salt, or potential caustic injuries from mistaking, for example, soda crystals for more caustic substances that might be in the kitchen cupboard instead, as shown in this poor dog's mouth here. So we don't want to have extra morbidity, but at the same time, a lot of these agents, if not all of them, aren't necessarily renowned for providing really effective gastric decontamination anyway, and so potentially these animals are left at an increased risk of later subsequent toxicity. So not something we're typically recommending. If you move on to talk about induction of emesis in the veterinary practice setting, then it's really important that we're reserving this technique for patients who are already asymptomatic. And the reason I say that is that if there's any clinical signs present at the time these patients present to the clinic, then it can increase the risk associated with them induction of emesis. But also, by the virtue of the fact that they're symptomatic, it tells us that the toxin's already been absorbed. So it's at best a sort of fairly potentially likely pointless procedure as well. However, if they are asymptomatic, then time really is of the essence, as we all know already. And there's several studies out there showing that the amount of gastric recovery is much, much higher the sooner after ingestion rather than later. And so a common question that often comes up is to how long after ingestion of a toxic substance can emesis be induced? Is there sort of a cutoff after which there's no point? And traditionally, we've had this sort of number of 4 hours in sort of a lot of the textbooks and a lot of the places you'll read to say that it's useful to perform induction of emesis up until 4 hours. But after that, we worry that things have moved along in the GI tract and therefore it's not terribly useful. So obviously the sooner the better within those 4 hours, but 4 hours has been viewed as a sort of a cutoff. In some circumstances, however, we know that delayed emesis induction can still be performed. So we're talking a little bit later out, so between 4 and 6 hours after exposure, again in this asymptomatic patient. But we're thinking about instances whereby the toxin may still be lurking around in the stomach, and therefore we might still be able to get it out. And certainly that's the case for toxins that might delay gastric emptying, as some of the drugs have listed here. By virtue of how they're acting, it means that they stick around longer for us to get them out. But something that we may not think of very commonly are if there's any toxins that are physically more likely to stay in the stomach for a longer duration of time, or form a sort of a large concretion or similar in the stomach, and therefore we might be able to get them out. And additional examples here that are probably maybe more relevant to a lot of our patients are animals that have eaten sort of large wads of xylitol gum or the vast amounts of chocolate, but even things like large sort of amounts of grapes and raisins can stick around in the stomach for a lot longer than those 4 hours. So as long as the patient's asymptomatic and there's no contraindication, we can consider inducing emesis beyond that sort of traditional 4 hour cutoff that we've had before. In terms of how we induce emesis in the various species, so the topic of the webinar today is what's new in toxicology. There's really very little new in inducing emesis in the dog, as in apomorphine remains the drug of choice in dogs. And typically, it works centrally and causes really rapid emesis. Lots of routes that we can give it if we have an injectable format. But if we don't and we're in a tight spot, then it is possible to dissolve tablets and actually crush a portion of the tablet, dissolve it in a few drops of water, and then administer it into the conjunctival sac. And it's so effective in a emetic agent, it can actually induce emesis via that route as well. And this route also has the nice benefit that after emesis has been achieved, we can just rinse out that conjunctival sac and the sort of the vomiting stops. So basically, lots and lots of options as to how we can give this drug. Side effects are really quite rare, it is, in the vast majority of cases, the benefit of giving this drug far outweighs any possible side effects. But we're also safe in the knowledge that if we did have a side effect that, for example, maybe a patient wasn't as asymptomatic as we thought, and we had any significant side effects, then this is a drug that can reverse any adverse effects without necessarily getting rid of the emetic effects as well by using something like naloxone. So pretty safe as agents go. We do need to make sure that the stomach has been emptied out effectively, though, after we've given apomorphine or similar. And I'm generally surprised and never cease to be amazed by just how much stuff our patients can eat. And this is a dog who decided to eat two whole tubs of I believe it was celebrations on a particularly festive time of the year. And the volume of chocolate and wrappers that came out of this dog was quite amazing. And one thing that we really need to watch these patients for is, yes, they may produce a lot of stuff, but we really want to get as much stuff out of their stomachs as possible. And so in an ideal world, they'll continue to vomit and bring things up until they get to the point of almost a dry heave. So they're trying to vomit, but nothing else is coming up. And that really implies that the stomach has been genuinely emptied and our emesis goal has been achieved. Whilst we've on the subject of emesis in dogs, a great question. We've got, would we induce emesis in a 5-month-old Labrador puppy that's eaten a sock? Absolutely, yes, as long as there's no, I guess I should probably put the caveat on that in terms of timing. If it was a very recent ingestion, so it's just happened and that's a sort of reason presenting to the practice, yes, definitely. Because I think, generally speaking, it's quite a successful mission, and it inevitably solves any sort of foreign body issue later down the line. So I think in the very recent ingestion, absolutely. I think that's probably a really good place to kind of get in to solve any problems later on. So great question. Moving on to cats, a little bit hit or miss, sadly, in terms of success in inducing emesis, certainly in my experience at least. And xylazine's been one of those agents that's traditionally been reported as the agent of choice in this species, and we know that it can have side effects such as sedation and bradycardia and various other things, maybe not always available, that specific alpha-2 agent, and we know that we can reverse it. And other drugs have been reported as well. However, my experience is that it has been a bit more hit or miss, and whereas I can feel pretty confident I can make a dog vomit with apomorphine, I'm really not sure if I'm going to be able to make a cat vomit. And so in terms of, is there anything in the literature, does anybody else share my pain with these patients? Well, there are a couple of recent studies actually looking at various agents for inducing emesis in cats to say how are we doing with the agents we have, and what is there anything better that we should be using. And the first of these papers I wanted to mention is this small study from 2017, where it looked at 48 cats that were given xylazine to induce emesis for a variety of reasons, and they looked at a lot of things to do with these patients, but the bottom line was that they were able to induce emesis successfully in about 60% of cats, with some sedation seen as the most common side effect. And so the conclusion was, yes, we're using xylazine, it's safe and it's reasonably effective. But if we think about some of the things that cats can eat and the potential side effects of those substances, 60% as a success rate isn't necessarily that great. So what I was interested to read was this sort of follow-up study, or this study rather from published elsewhere a couple of years previously, where they were actually looking at xylazine again, but in the context of other agents as well, to see was there anything that was more effective. So it's a little bit more comprehensive as a study. And they had, again, smallish numbers of cats, especially given the institution this study was published from. It's a very, very busy emergency room that Dr. Thorley works in. And they only had 43 cats over this period of time. But they were able to compare what happened with all of these various agents. And I summarised the results on the following slide, but it actually showed that we could consider agents like dexmedetomidine as potentially a more successful and maybe more readily available agent to induce emesis in cats as well. And if we kind of look at their numbers in sort of bigger font, a little bit easier to read, it seems like we were using a variety of different agents, and in terms of effectiveness, hydrogen peroxide was given to three of the cats in this study, maybe more of an American thing than a sort of UK thing, and it's not really an agent that's advised in cats because it's not that effective at making them vomit in a timely fashion, as this study showed with a 0% effectiveness. But also cats are more prone to developing gastritis or even hemorrhagic gastroenteritis from it than dogs are. So there's really nothing in this study to show that we should sort of change our stance on this agent in cats. But what was interesting in this study was that xylazine was slightly less effective at inducing emesis than the other study had shown us. So it was 44%, whereas dexmedetomidine was sort of 81%. And a sort of a common question, a good one again, is whether medetomidine would be as effective as dexmedetomidine. Nobody's done the sort of direct comparative study that I'm aware of, at least. But it's certainly an agent that we'll substitute in for dexmedetomidine and sort of use them interchangeably for this purpose. Whether or not it's as effective, I don't know, because it's thankfully, I suppose, most of our toxicity patients are dogs, and therefore we don't sort of run into this problem as much. So I don't know for sure if you'd reach this sort of 81% with medetomidine, but certainly I'd feel like I would sort of use them interchangeably. And in terms of sort of doses that we might use, the doses used in this study were as sort of provided here, so slightly higher dose for if it's given IM versus IV, and again probably comparative doses for medetomidine would seem reasonable as well. But the only other point to sort of mention here, which is worth kind of maybe specifying, is in comparison to dogs, where we give apomorphine and we can have a really, really effective rapid response, The elapsed time that they report in the study until emesis was induced was potentially quite a long time. So in the xylazine-treated cats, they were talking about sort of median of about 10 minutes or so, but the range was from 5 to 175 minutes. And in the dexmedetomidine-treated cats, the median interval was a lot less, so it was at 5 minutes with a range from 1 to 12. So kind of taking from this study, maybe it is going to take naturally a bit longer in cats. Maybe I just need to be a bit more patient sometimes before declaring that it hasn't worked, but just being prepared that it isn't going to be as instant or as successful as it is in dogs, unfortunately. So this is all great in terms of inducing emesis and reducing systemic exposure, but when is this not the right thing to do? And there's really two major categories that we'll consider. So if there's a patient at specifically increased risk of aspiration pneumonia, whether that be an inherent inability of theirs to sort of protect their airway or deal with any sort of potential aspiration event, such as any neurologic signs, pre-existing or specific to this intoxication, for example. I put this brachycephalics question mark, and I've put that there not to say necessarily that their breed is an absolute contraindication, but just to say that we are aware that they can have vagal responses to vomiting, and I'd put them at a slightly higher risk for potential complications after emesis induction. So it's not to say it's an absolute no, but more a risk-benefit assessment as to have they been exposed to a toxic dose, do we know this for sure, and offsetting that against the theoretical concerns for what would happen if they were to vomit and then have a vagal episode or aspirate, for example. So not necessarily a blanket no, but just a sort of pause for thought. And then if there's any substances that a patient's ingested that's particularly low viscosity, such as some of the ones I've listed here, they're very, very easy for patients to aspirate during this sort of episode of emesis, so probably are more of an absolute contraindication. And then if there's certain toxic substances that are caustic or corrosive, some of the particularly unpleasant things listed on the sort of second bullet point of this slide, then unfortunately emesis isn't recommended because of the risk of sort of secondary injury to that GI tract as the sort of emesis happens. So what do we do in a case where we want to decontaminate them, but emesis just isn't appropriate for any or hopefully not all of those reasons, but at least some of them? Then we can consider doing a gastric lavage. And this is where we said, again, for a symptomatic patient this time where emesis just isn't the way forward. And specific examples, we're not talking about doing this on every patient that presents. Obviously, this isn't a common procedure that we'll perform, but can be useful in patients where the specific toxicant has maybe a very narrow margin of safety that can cause really severe clinical signs, or where a patient has ingested close to that sort of lethal dose 50, where we think they could really be in trouble. And some examples of some of the toxins that may warrant gastric lavage might include things like metaldehyde or muscle relaxants like baclofen or some of the ivermectin, moxidectin kind of compounds where we know that we're going to see bad clinical signs. This might be a sort of an intervention where we can prevent that from happening. In terms of contraindications, again, not really suitable for caustic substance ingestions, and it's not complication-free. Certainly specific to this procedure, we can see things like aspiration pneumonia, hypothermia, depending on how much of a lavage has to be performed and the size of the patient, as we'll see in a second. And there are potential for electrolyte disturbances, given we're lavaging with copious amounts of water, but I have to say it's probably more of a theoretical concern than a sort of a definite complication, if that makes sense. So the actual steps that are taken to perform one of these, if this isn't something you've sort of seen or done previously, is that this is a procedure that's performed under general anaesthesia, so kind of fits with what we were saying, that we need a good reason why we're going to go ahead and do this. And it's absolutely imperative that we have a well-fitting endotracheal tube that's cuffed as one of the major safety defences we can have against the possibility for getting aspiration pneumonia. We'll pass a regular stomach tube, like we might use to decompress a GDV, for example, that's already lubricated and has been pre-measured to the correct location. So typically, before we place the tube, we'll pop it along the outside of the patient, as shown in this figure here, measuring it from the muzzle to the last rib, and then marking the tube with white tape or Sharpie or whatever we have available. It is really important that we make sure that tube is in the correct body system, so it's in the GI system, before we introduce any lavage liquids, obviously. And this is where one of the other advantages of having the patient intubated comes in, as in not only protecting against aspiration pneumonia, but also meaning that there's realistically nowhere else that a tube of this size can be put if there's a ET tube in the trachea as well. As we're passing this orogastric tube that's lubricated, then probably the easiest way to place it, if this is something you haven't done in one of these patients before, is by using a sort of gentle twisting kind of movement. And sometimes it can make it easier to pass if you blow into the other end of the tube as you're passing it to try and inflate the esophagus a little bit with air. It can sometimes just help open things up and sort of pass that tube down there. As we said, we'll be able to visualize that this tube is going in the right body system as well. Once the tube's in, then basically the lavage can happen. So we're instilling warmed water into that stomach tube, either using a sort of a funnel or something similar to get that fluid safely and unmessily into that tube. They say between sort of 10 and 20 mils per kilo, bearing in mind that the stomach can sort of hold up to sort of 60 to 90 mils per kilo. This is an amount to sort of get in, get some stuff out, and we can kind of repeat as needed on a fairly rapid basis. So it helps things just keep moving. When the fluid's been instilled, it's not very technical, the term slosh, but a sort of gentle agitation of the abdomen may be helpful to move that fluid around and help sort of rinse out and mobilize any toxin in the stomach. And then to retrieve that fluid, we'll place the end of the stomach tube below the patient into a suitable container to empty the contents that we can collect for toxicologic analysis if needed. Get that out, put more and warm water in, and repeat until we basically get no more contents retrieved. It is recommended to do what's called a three-sided lavage, so to have the patient positioned in both left and right lateral recumbences and also in sternal, just to try and get all of those sort of pockets out. So that can be worth trying, especially in these sort of massive ingestions of really quite harmful substances. And then once we're at the point of removing the tube, then we can consider how best to do that safely. And an easy way of doing that is to kink the sort of the tube over prior to it being removed, just to prevent any sort of additional lavage fluid being sort of spilled into the esophagus and maybe aspirated later. And providing this sort of kink in the tube can be really useful. And then it's a case of making sure that our last defense against aspiration pneumonia is just extubating the patient only when we're happy that the gag reflex has returned at the end of the procedure as well. So clearly not something we're going to employ with all of our patients, but worth considering in sort of the more severely affected ones. Another important aspect of gastrointestinal decontamination is the use of activated charcoal. So again, we're probably all familiar with this agent. Its use certainly isn't new in veterinary medicine, but the basic principle behind it is that it's a carbonaceous compound that really acts by binding toxins within the GI tract to prevent them being systemically absorbed. And the recommendation is that if we're using them, that they're given as soon as possible after the gastric emptyings has happened, whether that be induction of emesis or lavage, as we've just talked about. Because we know from the human literature that administration is most effective within an hour of sort of toxin ingestion, although, again, it's one of those things that we can't exclude any benefit to it beyond the hour. So the sooner the better is the way forward. And if we have induced emesis and we have a patient who's still a little bit nauseous or still not kind of ready for eating anything else in the short term, then we might consider providing antiemetic therapy at that point to be able to get this charcoal in a timely fashion. The dose kind of commonly used I've included on this slide, and most of our canine patients thankfully will eat this stuff. I guess if they were silly enough to eat something they shouldn't in the first place, it would be a little bit irksome if they didn't eat our charcoal nicely. So a lot of the time they will eat it in food, and that's all fine. We do have to be quite careful if we're syringe feeding to make sure that we're not providing an extra risk for aspiration. And in cats, I think, again, it comes down to one of those risk-benefit scenarios whereby is it important? Do I think that it's going to improve the clinical course of their poisoning for them to get it if they want to eat it voluntarily? And if so, to what means do I want to go to do that? Will I kind of offer them food? And indeed, so we do have occasional cats that will eat this voluntarily, but not that many of them. Or if I think it's really, really important, then we can consider placing a nasogastric tube, checking its placement and delivering the sort of liquid charcoal that way. But we'll kind of offset that against any possible contraindications as listed here. So again, a lot of them based on reducing the risk of aspiration, but also bearing in mind the possibility if there's any hint of a sort of needing any hint of a possible sort of GI perforation, then that's a potential concern if this charcoal subsequently leaks into the abdomen. So in terms of should we give it or not, unless it's contraindicated, yes, a dose may well help is probably limited in terms of its side effects. And we'll talk on the next slide about instances where we might actually want to give more than one dose, in fact. So in toxins where there's a delayed release, so this intoxication is going to go on for a long time, if there's a long half-life, or if there's a sort of recirculation of the toxin, then we might give it even more than once. But when not to give it, clearly if there's a contraindication, but also if there's just no physical, if there won't be physical binding of the toxin that's been ingested to the charcoal. As some of the agents listed here, of which it's a little bit frustrating, some of the ones listed here, certainly the top three, would be really quite nice if they did bind to charcoal. But I guess if it's not going to work, then it's probably no benefit to that particular patient. We mentioned that we might want to give charcoal repeatedly, and we know, of course, that there are some toxins that undergo what's termed this enterohepatic recirculation. So what we mean here is that these are just five of the sort of common toxins that will do this. But of course, if we're investigating any specific toxin, we can look up and see if that's on the list of them. But we're talking about recirculation of toxins in the body between the liver and the intestines. So many toxins or their metabolites are released in bile and then get secreted into the small intestine, but then are uptaken by the portal vein back in the blood to the liver again, where they could expose the body to sort of a second hit. And so by giving repeated doses of charcoal, it just means there's more likely to be charcoal present in the intestine that will bind up any of these toxins before they'll get a chance to be reabsorbed again. And certainly common ones that we see, things like nonsteroidals and methylxanthines from sort of chocolate toxicity, are really good candidates for this sort of repeated charcoal approach. We might also consider using what's termed a cathartic. So these are substances that act to decrease absorption of poisons or toxins by accelerating their expulsion from the GI tract. A few of them out there is listed here, although sorbitol is probably one of the most common ones. And depending on your formulation of charcoal, you may have one of these substances already combined with charcoal. So by giving a single dose of this product, you've kind of done a couple of things to try and decrease GI absorption. But something that it's important to be aware of is that whilst we can repeat charcoal, as we talked about, cathartics are a sort of a one-shot deal, for the reason that if we give them more than once, we can just see more side effects, whether that be related to excessive fluid losses from this sort of increased expulsion of material from the GI tract, or indeed some pretty potentially severe electrolyte disturbances related to sodium in particular. So cathartics can be useful, but if we're using them as a sort of single entity. And obviously antidotes to any specific intoxications are nice for sure, and certainly should be considered where available and where applicable. But even if we're administering these, and I've listed some of the more sort of common ones that we might think about, we're still needing to manage the rest of the patient depending on whether the effects of the toxin are already present and sort of how they're doing generally. So important, but sort of part of the general treatment package, obviously. Another way that we might help to minimise this sort of systemic effects of toxins that the patient's been exposed to is diuresis in some cases. So it might help to actually clear toxins that are renally excreted, or it might just help support the kidneys if they're a target organ of a particular toxicity, like the sort of Lilly poisonings in cats, for example. And the basic principle is we're giving between 2 and 3 times maintenance fluid rates for 2 to 3 days, just being mindful of the fact that if the kidneys are likely to have their functionality affected, we just need to make sure we're monitoring urine outputs and so on and body weights potentially in these sort of at-risk patients to try and prevent any fluid overload. And another kind of in or defense we have against renally excreted toxins is that in, for example, sort of classic cases in the really severe chocolate toxicities where the patient's really symptomatic, because we know their metabolites are excreted in the urine but can cross the bladder wall and be sort of systemically absorbed again. In those really severely affected patients, we can place a urinary catheter and a closed collection system so that that urine doesn't have any increased contact time to be reabsorbed, and we just really take that out of the body and stop those systemic effects. So there might be a sort of other renal system cheats that we can use to try and decrease that absorption. And then probably the most exciting development, I would say, in veterinary toxicology in recent times has been the application of what's termed this intravenous lipid emulsion, or ILE for short, as a sort of almost a decontamination strategy in our patients as well. And typically we're using the substance Intralipid 20%, so it's something that we can is easily available from pharmacies and from sort of the veterinary suppliers and so on. And the story is behind this isn't necessarily new to our patients, as in this is a product that's been used for quite some time, but more in the context of parenteral nutrition or as a vehicle for drug delivery, for example, propofol, sort of one of the classic examples. But what is maybe newer about it is that it's evolving as a potential almost antidote for sort of lipophilic drug toxicosis. So it's sort of a new application of something that's been around for a long time. And this Intralipid 20% specifically, what is it? Well, it's a soybean oil-based emulsion of really long-chain triglycerides. And it's not necessarily a foreign substance to the body by any means. So the fat droplets in these lipid solutions are really similar to what we'd sort of expect to be happening endogenously with fat metabolism. And as such, we know the body handles these substances very much like it would a normal fat load, so it's cleared by many tissues in the body quite nicely. And we also know that they're broken down to things like glycerol and free fatty acids, which the body can actually find quite a useful thing as a sort of energy source. So it's a physiologically sound product to administer. But of more interest, how does it actually work? And if you sort of do any additional reading into this, then there's lots of different mechanisms proposed as to how it does. And it may well be the case, it's a little bit academic, to be honest, in terms of exactly which one is working for a given toxin. But it's nice that there's quite a few, so there's potential overlap. But we are thinking about the sort of main mechanisms as being a sort of lipid sink or sequestration effect that we'll talk about in the next slide. Or there's potential other metabolic effects that might just improve how the heart's performing, as well as the potential for not necessarily acting to trap toxins, but maybe increasing distribution of toxins to kind of more fat-soluble tissues and just decreasing the load of toxin that any particular tissue in the body has to be exposed to. But what I personally think is quite interesting is this sort of lipid sink effect. And The basic principle behind this is that this lipid's infused intravenously and remains in the circulation for a period of time where it will bind to these highly lipid-soluble toxins just by virtue of the fact that it is a lipid after all. And what this does quite nicely is that then that effectively traps that toxin in that plasma lipid compartment, where then it can be removed from the body routinely, as we've talked about. But the ultimate upshot of that is by trapping it in that compartment, there's less free toxin available to go into the tissues. And of course, in intoxication patients, it's generally the free toxin that's the really harmful stuff. And so basically by binding it, by trapping it in this sort of lipid sink, it's reduced the sort of toxic load that the body is exposed to. And so in doing so, it's really helping to sort of decrease exposure to help clear the offending toxin. And rather than just acting to protect the tissues from it, there's some evidence to say that maybe this lipid sink effect might be strong enough to actually pull any of those lipophilic toxins away from where they're already elsewhere in the body causing trouble, especially organs like the heart and brain. It can almost suck those toxins out of those organs that it's damaging into this lipid sink and then therefore help clear it from the body. And there's certainly evidence for that. So there's several case studies of dogs who've ingested ivermectin-like substances and have been given these this intralipid therapy. And at the time, they've had blood levels of these various toxins measured. And it was initially postulated that the lipid would be given and the toxin level would go down over time, and that would sort of make a lot of sense. And what's actually been shown in some patients is that after giving the lipid, the blood concentrations of the toxin actually went up. And you might initially think, well, why would that be? That doesn't really sound like a good thing. But that probably is representing the fact that this high lipid load has actually pulled these toxins into the bloodstream away from sort of harm's reach, where it can then be excreted. So there's evidence to say that it's probably protective as well as being proactive in terms of helping the other tissues as well. And then there's some evidence to say that these lipids can improve cardiac performance, which could be quite helpful if our toxin had any sort of adverse cardiovascular effects, maybe by virtue of the fact that it's a better energy source for the heart, and maybe sort of it could help reverse any sort of cardiovascular dysfunction if that was present with a specific toxin. And so before we kind of get too excited about sort of using lipid in everything, it is important to say that initial clinical approach that we mentioned where we're stabilizing the patient first before moving on to other strategies, that still stands. And our patients still need to be stabilized, especially cardiovascularly, before we contemplate using lipid. And it should really be a sort of a supplement rather than a substitute for sort of traditional therapies, even though it is kind of new and interesting and we're finding sort of new uses for it all of the time. And the sort of veterinary applications for it are growing continually. So this is a list of substances in which it has been used in veterinary patients, small animal veterinary patients, and it's used reported successfully. Certainly one the sort of the initial application in human medicine was sort of local anesthetic overdose, but probably some of the earlier case reports and case studies in veterinary patients were of ivermectin toxicities and so on, as we've talked about. But notably things like pyrethrin exposures, tremorogenic mycotoxins, probably one of the biggest indications we're using in our clinic currently, but also metaldehyde, baclofen, the muscle relaxant, lots and lots of applications, certainly some of the nastier toxins, if you like, on the list of potential applications, which is quite nice. And although it's not going to be the magic bullet, what's reported and certainly what we've seen clinically is that its use can really shorten the sort of duration of clinical signs and really reduce the severity of them as well. And I guess in our species, it may well be that it stops a patient becoming so severely affected that we avoid a sort of life-threatening severity. Or it might be that because time is money, we just are able to sort of manage patients for longer and provide supportive care before we potentially run out of months and money and find ourselves unable to treat these patients. So potential benefits in that regard. And also, in terms of rapid turnaround, certainly our experience with using them for the tremorogenic mycotoxins has been that whereas previously we'd have these dogs that might be in the hospital for 2, 3 days, might be on propofol infusions, incurring expense and potentially complications during that time, we find that when we give them lipid therapy up front, some of them are even ready to go home by the end of the following day. So it's a really marked difference in clinical turnaround. Obviously not the case for every single one of them, but we have had some really positive experience with it. And as you said, the list of potential applications for it is growing the whole time. If we are using it, how much do we give? Well, we're not 100% sure, to be perfectly honest, in terms of what an effective dose is. And the initial dose that we have and that published in reviews on this subject have really been extrapolated from human medicine and previous parenteral nutrition dosing. And so what's currently recommended, and this is sort of subsequent to change, and maybe we'll learn more as we get more experience with this stuff, is a sort of initial conservative dose where we're talking about 1.5 mL per kilo of the 20% intralipid solution, given as a bolus over about 5 minutes to get blood levels up quickly, and then followed by a continuous rate infusion at a lower dose over the next sort of 30 to 60 minutes, repeating every sort of 1 to 4 hours as sort of determined by sort of clinical response. And this is usually what we start with, and most of the time it sort of does the trick quite nicely. But again, there are doses reported for if that isn't cutting it. So if a patient's sort of non-responsive to this more conservative dosing, then we can give a sort of bolus therapy, followed by a higher rate, continuous rate infusion, with the clinical endpoints being resolution of clinical signs or until 24 hours has elapsed, or until the serum has become lipemic, as in we think we've sort of saturated that body compartment with lipid anyway. That said, there's no real safety studies evaluating the use of this stuff in the clinically poisoned veterinary patient, and therefore, regardless of which dose we're using, even if we're going with more of a conservative dose, then we still need to be monitoring these patients quite carefully and sort of doing a sort of risk assessment to see whether or not we think it's the right thing to do. On the bright side, though, we are thinking about using them in these toxins with high morbidity or known sort of potential for mortality. Certainly, if we think of the list of drugs that we just showed a couple of slides ago, they're not particularly favorable toxins to have systemic effects from. And we said we're kind of not using it as our first line. We're using it as sort of a stepwise approach to these patients. And so we're kind of, even though we said that we don't have these safety studies to sort of rely on, we're typically using them when the sort of there is a favorable argument for their use. Hopefully we're seeing some response, and we're learning a bit more all of the time as well. In terms of adverse effects, there's some stuff written up in the human literature, not a whole lot in our sort of veterinary clinical patients. We know that we are making these patients lipemic. It's kind of almost the, not necessarily the aim of it, obviously the aim is decreasing sort of systemic effects of toxins, but the lipemia is a sort of necessary evil for that. Although we typically think about it as being transient, it does resolve pretty quickly. And although we might worry about the risk of pancreatitis or similar, that isn't something that's been sort of particularly investigated as a sole entity, but equally not something that's been commonly reported. And generally speaking, we tend to think these things have a high safety margin. Like we said, we've used them previously in parenteral nutrition and in propofol CRIs and so on. So we tend to think about adverse effects being pretty uncommon. Although it pays to be on the lookout, and something that we're kind of monitoring at the moment is on the basis of this case report where they reported that a cat who received this intravenous lipid therapy after a permethrin toxicosis, and if you kind of can read the sort of small print, actually a pretty conservative dose was given to this cat. There was a 48-hour period of gross lipemia and then some initial ocular changes consistent with corneal lipidosis that were present and resolved within a week. So maybe the more we use of this, the more side effects we'll see. But equally, if we're offset against a life-threatening toxin, then we're still sort of deciding, is it in that patient's best interests? And just to finish up in terms of other ways of getting toxins out of the body, there are options for more aggressive or advanced techniques such as extracorporeal treatments to literally clear the blood of these toxins, where we might consider it in some specific instances. But clearly, owing to availability and cost and sort of patient suitability, is pretty much at the bottom of the list at this present time, and we'll sort of work through the things that we talked about already. The final part of the sort of patient care plan was to treat the patient and sort of provide organ support and general nursing and management of that patient. And what we do there is really going to be very specific depending on what we know that toxin to do. So given that we hopefully know more about the toxin a patient has been exposed to, we know the resources that we can go to find out more. We're less reliant on our crystal ball to kind of predict what's going to happen. We can have a pretty good knowledge, so we know what organ systems to monitor and what we can kind of expect from the future of these patients. And so hopefully what we've kind of covered in this webinar today is a sort of general approach to these patients, but hopefully we've at least addressed these sort of traditionally reported top five mistakes made in poisoning cases. And in doing so, hopefully it'll help with any sort of subsequent poisoning patients you see. So hopefully you've picked up something useful from that. I'm happy to answer any other questions people might have.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Lindsay for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.